solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Yes. It's typically these habits are formed based on how we grew up. And not necessarily by our family of origin, although very commonly that is, you know, what we see modeled by our families is often what we pick up about how we're supposed to deal with conflict. So I've often had clients say to me, you know, in my family, we just avoided conflict. It was a very quiet dinner table. There was no conflict, but that doesn't mean that conflict didn't exist. Is my, you know, what my point to them is, that doesn't mean conflict didn't exist. It just means that people's way of dealing with it was to not deal with it.
Welcome to the 73rd conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. And this podcast is my labor of love for the long term to have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and other leading professionals to decode insights around leadership, transitions, and careers. When I'm not podcasting, I'm usually working with leaders as a trusted sounding board, helping leaders and organizations play to their fullest potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. My guest this time is Dr. Jennifer Goldman-Wetzler, a leading expert on conflict and organizational psychology. She's a founder and CEO of Alignment Strategies Group and author of Optimal Outcomes, Freeing Yourself from Conflict at Work, at Home, and in Life, published by Harper Business in 2020. For two decades, she's advised leaders at global corporations in a wide range of industries, as well as at large nonprofit and governmental institutions. Earlier in her career, she was a facilitator at the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School. She's a former counterterrorism research fellow with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and she received her BA with honors from Tufts University and holds a PhD in social organizational psychology from Columbia University. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Dr. Jennifer Goldman-Wetzler.
Jen, thanks so much for your time on the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you so much, Deepak. It's great to be here with you.
And in this podcast, we talk about people's journeys and insights around leadership transitions and careers. Before we dive into the book you've written around conflict resolution, Jen, I'd love to get a sense of the arc of your curiosity and how you ended up researching conflict. So if it's okay with you, we'd love to get a sense of how you ended up writing this book and the sequence of events leading up to it.
Absolutely. Well, it's important always, I think, to start from the beginning. And that starts with my two grandmothers. So when I was growing up, I had Grandma Florence, who was what I call our family's first conflict whisperer. So I grew up in a family of screamers and door slammers. And Grandma Florence was really the opposite of that. She was so calm just by her very presence. She could just calm us down. And so we would often drive, my brother and me in the back seat and my parents in the front seat. We would drive from our little red brick building in the Bronx each Sunday to my aunt and uncle's house in the Connecticut suburbs. And my Grandma Florence would sit in the middle of me and my brother in the back seat. And there would be screaming, inevitably screaming every which way in the car on the way home. And Grandma Florence, just by saying, "Sha, sha, quiet, quiet," she would, in her very calm Yiddish way, really just calm everybody down somehow. And on the other side of my family, my Oma, my grandmother, Helen, and my grandfather, my Opa, Hans, they had immigrated to this country, to America from Vienna, Austria, but it took them many years, 6 years of a journey through Switzerland and Portugal and Italy, and eventually to the Dominican Republic, where my father was born during the war. And then once the war ended, they were able to come to New York. So they went through a lot of traumatic experiences over those years. My grandfather never saw his father or one of his brothers again. The rest of his brothers ended up moving to Australia and thankfully were safe, but were far flung for the rest of their lives. And so I think out of that trauma came a lot of grief that was unprocessed and kind of turned into anger. And so there is a legacy of grief and anger in that side of the family. And so I think it was for me the combination of growing up in a family of, you know, the anger and the screaming and the model of my grandma Florence that really enabled me to be in the eye of the storm with people who are in conflict and to be able to be that conflict whisperer for them. And you know, that's been true for me and my family as I've gotten older in my family today, and also with friends and colleagues and obviously with my clients as well. So that's just the beginning of the journey. And then when I got to beyond college, you know, in college, decided to study conflict resolution, it was just something I was naturally drawn to. And then I went to go study in Jerusalem for my junior year abroad of college, which is in many ways, you know, it's called the City of Peace, but I think it should really be called the City of Diversity or the City of Conflict as well. So I really, you know, really learned about international conflict there and identity conflict there. And then my whole career for 25 years has been focused on negotiation, conflict. I began my career at the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School and at several organizations affiliated with it in Boston, Massachusetts. And then I came back to New York, where I'm from originally, to do my PhD in social and organizational psychology with a focus on intractable conflict, where I studied humiliation. So all of my work at Columbia, where I was studying, was funded by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, because I was looking at how does the emotion of humiliation drive or exacerbate long-term conflicts. And I began my research in 2002 when the U.S. Department of Homeland Security had just been founded after 9/11. And so they had just created a new fellowship program and had invited me to apply. So I did, and they funded my work for 5 years. And then I came out and I realized I had been studying how we get stuck in long-term conflicts and all the complex factors that contribute to that. But I really, and I knew I could spend the rest of my life just looking at the ways we get stuck. And I said to myself, I need to pivot. I need to look at how can we get out of these long-term conflicts. And so that's been the last 14 years of my life has been spent looking at how can we get out of these conflicts that seem to go around and around and around. And how can we stay out? How can we free ourselves from these kinds of situations? So I've been working, I founded an organization called Alignment Strategies Group, where we help CEOs and their senior teams to collaborate across lines of difference, and across lines of differences of worldview, of opinion, and to create optimal outcomes for themselves and their teams as a result of having those tough conversations.
And maybe just before we dive into the book, Jen, could you define what's conflict and maybe shine the light on healthy conflict?
Yeah. Well, conflict can be healthy when it happens once and people can talk about what's happening and then figure out a way forward, right? So it can lead to, it's, you know, a ton of research has been done that shows that when people come from diverse perspectives, have different points of view, they talk about it, that can lead to more innovative solutions, more creative solutions. So, you know, one-off conflict can be a healthy thing. But when you find that you're going around and around and having the same argument with someone over and over again, or it's not the same argument, it's about different content pieces, but the nature of it is the same, right? Where you're blaming me and I'm blaming you back, even if one day we're talking about the dishes and the next day we're talking about a PowerPoint presentation or whatever, it does, you know, but the pattern is similar, blame, blame. In that case, this becomes unproductive, unhealthy, not useful, and that's my work, is to say, how can we help you ourselves? How can we help ourselves get off of that, what I call conflict loop?
So let's talk about the conflict loop, Jen. You actually say that we end up getting into a vicious loop and we struggle to get out of it. Can you talk a little bit about what the conflict loop is? And, you know, and of course, we'll talk at length about how we get out of this, but it'd be good to talk about the conflict loop first.
Sure. When we are stuck in conflict, we've got our conflict habit that interacts with other people's conflict habits, and those conflict habits form a pattern of interaction. And they tend to get locked in this pattern of interaction. And so if you think about this as like a circle, that's just a never-ending circle. It just goes around and around and around. You can imagine yourself stuck on this conflict loop. And the question that all of my work today really deals with is, how do we put a break in this pattern so that we can have a little space to move and ask ourselves, how can I get off of this conflict loop?
And you talk about common conflict habits and you break them into four. You briefly spoke about one of them, but could you sort of lay out the framework here, Jen, in a way? This is sort of the underlying foundation based on which we start realizing where we are coming from and where the other person is coming from. So if you could talk a little bit about the four different approaches to conflict that we end up gravitating towards.
Yes. So there are four conflict habits. One of them is one that I mentioned before, which is that some of us, in our quest to win a conflict, we might feel competitive. And this can be a healthy thing. But when we take it to an extreme, when we habitually want to win a conflict, it can get to the point where we end up, or other people end up experiencing us as blaming them. And so we will kind of go on the attack and blame other people. In contrast, others of us habitually blame ourselves. We may blame and shame ourselves. So again, we may do this with good intentions. So our intention may be to learn from a situation and do better next time. But when we habitually do this, sometimes we end up stewing in our own negative self-talk, which doesn't free us from any kind of conflict whatsoever. It just keeps us stuck in that conflict situation. The third conflict habit is shutdown. And that is where we may, again, well-intentionally avoid a conflict situation, which can be a helpful way to deal with conflict when, for example, the issue is not that important to you, or the person you're dealing with is not that important to you. And so avoidance can be useful. But again, when that's the only way that we know how to deal with conflict and we're avoiding issues that are important, or we're avoiding people whose relationships are important to us, then it becomes an unhealthy way to deal with conflict. And what typically happens is that the conflict, you know, will avoid. The conflict is kind of bubbling slowly, simmering, simmering, and then boom, you know, it explodes at a point when we least expect it. And then we have to go deal with that. And we're not prepared. And then finally, one of the other ones that we talked about before is relentlessly collaborate. And that is where we have been taught, often, like we were saying before, from a young age, that the way to deal with conflict is to offer other people options, think about what their interests might be, come up with creative solutions, work with them to come up with those creative solutions. And again, that's a really excellent toolbox and skill set to have. And for so many millennia, people didn't have that way of thinking about dealing with conflict. And we got into all sorts of messes because we didn't have that skill set. But even that, people can get so tied and committed to using this collaborative skill set that we end up pouring energy, time, resources, money into trying to work things out with someone or a group of people who just aren't interested in collaborating or cooperating with us. And so there's all that, you know, wasted time, money, energy, resources down the drain. And so there's got to be a better way. So actually, there's a free quiz online that people can take if they're interested to find out which one of these four conflict habits is your default. And if you go to optimaloutcomesbook.com/assessment, you'll find the quiz and you can take it. It's fun and helps people figure it out quickly.
I'm sure. And I guess to your point, blaming, shutting down, and shaming have a negative connotation. But as you say, collaboration has a positive connotation in most situations. So it's quite counterintuitive to hear that it could sort of be a limiting factor in us getting to a meaningful place. Could you talk a little bit about maybe what sorts of circumstances lead us to one of these four clusters? I'm sure each journey is unique, but are there kinds of situations that lead people to eventually to gravitate towards one of these four buckets?
Yes. It's typically these habits are formed based on how we grew up and not necessarily by our family of origin, although very commonly that is, what we see modeled by our families is often what we pick up about how we're supposed to deal with conflict. So I've often had clients say to me, in my family, we just avoided conflict. It was a very quiet dinner table. There was no conflict, but that doesn't mean that conflict didn't exist. What my point to them is, that doesn't mean conflict didn't exist. It just means that people's way of dealing with it was to not deal with it. Similarly, like I was saying before about relentlessly collaborating, I learned as a 20-year-old in my first company that I worked with called Interaction Associates, it was very big on collaboration and taught people how to collaborate with each other. And so I think a lot of people learn that when you're in a work environment. But you could certainly learn from a young age how to deal with conflict from things that you learn at school, from teachers. Or from other family members, or from religious figures in your life. But people, we typically pick these things up without realizing that we're picking them up from a pretty young age.
Got it. And as I was reading your book, Jen, what I found interesting was, mathematically speaking, if we sort of take the fact that we could fall into one of the four conflict habits, and the person on the other side could be one of the four, it leads to 16 sort of permutations. But I noticed that in your book, you say that there are five patterns which are more common than the rest. Blame, shame, blame, shutdown, relentlessly collaborate, shutdown, and blame. And just as I eyeballed it, I got the sense that blame and shutdown are possibly more commonly found among people than the rest. Would that be a fair way of understanding the context here?
I thought that was such an interesting insight. You wrote me that before we spoke, and I remember that, and I think that's a really interesting insight. I have to say, I don't know. I have not done the analysis on people who've taken the quiz to see if there are major differences, and I can and should potentially do that. All the data is completely anonymous, and we do have the data. So I should look at it and do that analysis. My sense, though, just anecdotally, having worked with thousands of people who are my students at Columbia and also clients in all kinds of corporate and academic and nonprofit and governmental environments, is that there feels to me like it's a pretty even breakdown. So I have over the last 10 years done a exercise on the first night of the 3-day workshop that I give at Columbia for graduate students on optimal outcomes. And I have people self-identify. This was before I created the quiz online. And so people would self-identify in one of these four conflict habits groups. And generally speaking, those four corners of the room that I would send people to were pretty evenly distributed. So I'm not sure that it's about that. The best thing I can chalk it up to is that there are certain patterns that are easier to get locked into than others. And so, for example, blame, shame is a perfect, I think, example of this, where if you have a conflict habit of you shame yourself, you blame yourself, you might be naturally drawn to someone, to be in relationship with someone who is a blamer. That's a very natural pattern to get stuck in. The blamer will be naturally attracted to you, and you will be naturally attracted to them because you're already shaming yourself and you're going to find someone who's going to kind of lay it on you. That's what you attract. And they, and a blamer needs someone who's going to allow them to blame them, allow the person to blame. So, I think that's more how it works. Same thing with blame. You know, often, like in my family, and I talk about this very honestly in the book, my mom and I were stuck in a blame pattern for many, many years. And, you know, that was not fun or easy, but it does kind of make sense. I grew up in my parents' home, and there was a lot of screaming and yelling. And so as much as I had my grandma Florence as that model of how to deal with conflict, which was to stay calm and allow, you know, she was the eye of the storm for others, I also had this model of blaming and anger. And so I know how to do that really well too. and so I think blamers can also find each other, and that's a really sticky pattern, conflict loop to get stuck in as well. So those are just two examples. Does that help? Is that a helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great insight. It's not so much about the incidence of these five types, but probably the stickiness of these kinds of conflict patterns, which possibly makes them stand out for you. So I think that's an interesting nuance. I hadn't quite processed it that way. I think moving on, Jen, you talk about the notion of listening. And you talk about the importance of understanding the nuances of the conflict situation you're in. And you say that when we're in conflict, there's a tendency to get binary in the way we read the situation. Could you talk a little bit more? I found that supremely insightful.
Yes. Right. So exactly what you said. When we are stuck in conflict, our attention tends to narrow and focus. And this helps us when we are in a really difficult physical situation, right? If you are facing the face of a tiger, you want to either fight or flee. And so it can help to really narrow your focus on what is in front of you, the problem that's in front of you, and then, you know, almost in a reflex kind of way, figure out what you're going to do. The problem is that when we're facing a more modern, less physically threatening situation, conflict is typically much more complex than that. And so a situation that can seem like it's just about you and me, and it's just about what I say and what you say or what you do and what I do, can actually be more complex. And so when we don't allow ourselves to notice that complexity surrounding the situation, or that's a part of the situation, we lose the opportunity to gain valuable insight about the nuances and about the influencing factors that exist that could actually serve as important levers for change in that situation. So there's a practice that I've used for 10 years that I originally learned from one of my professors, from my advisor, Dr. Peter Coleman, who runs the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution at Columbia University in New York. And it's a great practice that people can do even in 2 minutes. I've seen people have major light bulbs go off and major aha moments from doing this practice. So basically what you do is you start with a blank piece of paper. And you can also do this online. In fact, if people want to go to optimaloutcomesbook.com/map, you can find a way to do this online. There's some very cool online mapping software that we found that's available for free on the website. But you take out a blank piece of paper. And the first step is just put down the names of the people who are involved in whatever situation is occurring for you. So that might be, you know, if you and I, Deepak, were involved in some kind of situation that was hard for us to deal with, I would put your name and my name down on the map. And then I would put circles around each of our names, and I would have a line between us to show that we're in relationship with each other. Then I would ask myself to get creative and think about who else is involved in this situation. Well, maybe there's you know, the person that you report to and the person that I report to. And then there's all the people who report to either each of us. And then there's my family of origin and there's your family of origin, and they might influence the way that each of us tends to approach problems and our thinking and our ways of dealing with conflict, and I'd put them on the map. So I start to really get creative and think about what is influencing this situation, what or who, what other factors, what other ideas, what's influencing and also influenced by this situation, and put that on the map as well. So the next step is to get really even more creative and put on your map anything that would be helping you think about this situation in a different way than you have before. So I've seen people put colors on their map and names of emotions on their map and stars and hearts and X's to show relationships that aren't doing well or that are very loving. Anything that can help you view the situation in a different way, put on your map. And then the final step in this practice is to take a step back and observe your map and ask yourself, what story does this map tell that might be different from the story I was telling myself about the situation before I drew my map? And typically, again, there's, you know, insights. Often people, for example, a very common insight is, oh, wow, I didn't realize that the way this person has been treating me that I've had such trouble with, I can't stand that, I feel so micromanaged, for example, right? That's like a very common complaint in workplaces. My manager is just micromanaging me and I can't stand it. I've had someone like literally within 2 minutes of doing this practice say, oh, I just noticed that my manager may be feeling micromanaged by her manager. And that doesn't take away the pain that I have experienced over the last many months of feeling micromanaged, but it does help explain why she may be doing this. And it can give me a little bit of empathy for her in a way that I just was not able to access before.
Gives perspective, I guess, to what's going on.
Yes.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. Picking up from what Jennifer says, I do think when we are deep into conflict, we end up seeing things in a binary fight, flight, or fright kind of a prism. And that's possibly due to the several thousand years of evolution. It's worth thinking about how we look at the situation with nuance rather than embracing a simplistic storyline. Something similar came up with my conversation with Jennifer Garvey Berger, author of the book Unlocking Leadership Mind Traps. She talks about five common traps a lot of us tend to fall into, and one of the traps she talks about is a trap of falling for simplistic stories.
Well, so it's, we kind of fall in love with our own conclusions, and we fall in love with our own stories without even noticing their stories. You can hear it in our language. Like, you hear people say, well, it's obvious that, or it's totally clear that. I hear it in my language all the time. And almost never is it actually obvious, the thing that I'm talking about. And so forcing ourselves to listen to when we have a simple story, like, it's obvious what the government should do here. Completely not obvious what any government should do right now. Completely not obvious. And so when we hear ourselves interacting with a complex set of ideas as though it were simple, then we know that we are in this trap. And so I think the solution there is to be able to construct a series of alternate stories, not to confuse us, but in a kind of almost a scenario planning way, not to try and get the right one, but to try to help us understand that there are these multiple possibilities. None of them are likely to be 100% right. And to help us create a kind of a flexibility of our thinking that will hold us in good stead.
I guess most situations are more nuanced and complex than we think they initially are. Taking the time and creating the space to assimilate the entire context might be helpful in us understanding the plot with all its nuances. If this is of interest, you might like my conversation with Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself, a leadership development company incubated in Google. He speaks about how we all can develop response flexibility rather than reacting to a situation. If you're seeing the value in the podcast, please consider rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. do also consider contributing to Antarang Foundation, a nonprofit that I work with closely. It helps young adults from challenging backgrounds get to the world of formal employment. I guess this COVID-19 pandemic has been about us walking the tightrope between lives and livelihoods. And as we speak, India is going through its second wave, or tsunami rather, in terms of cases, and all the attention is now being diverted to saving lives, understandably. But in all this, let's not forget the issue of livelihoods that we need to solve for and helping these young adults with opportunities. Please visit playtopotential.com/paidforward, PAYITFORWARD, for more details. Let's now get back to the conversation with Jen Goldman-Witzler.
I think picking on one of the things you said, Jen, and maybe linking it up with something that you talk about later in the book as well. You talk about using colors or, you know, drawing stars or finding other creative ways of expressing the conflict. Later in the book, you talk about using the different senses. You use that in a different context. You talk about the Martin Luther King speech in the way he sort of appeals to the various senses and the way we think about the future. If I may ask a broader question, what do you see the role of the various senses, both in terms of building awareness of where we are in the conflict, but also in the context of coming up to a better place?
Great question. The reason why this is a central part of the optimal outcomes methodology is because of my experience working with real people in real organizations who I saw struggling to know what they even wanted. You know, it's impossible to collaborate with other people if you don't know what you're hoping for, right? Oftentimes, when we're stuck in conflict, we are so focused on what went wrong and on who's to blame, whether it's ourselves or other people or some combination of both, that we neglect to kind of pick our heads up out of the sand and ask ourselves, hey, wait a minute, what would I like to see happen here in the future? And so this practice of imagining the future is all about asking people to stop, pause, and ask themselves this really important question. But when I started to ask people to do this, what I quickly realized was you can ask someone to imagine what they want in the future, and they'll give you all nice, you know, words about it, but it will be meaningless if they don't put down the thinking hat and pick up the imagination hat instead. Basically, if you're stuck in long-term conflict, you've probably tried many times to figure out, you know, a creative solution, right? Especially because this win-win negotiation methodology has been around for 4 decades. So most people do know about it and have been trained in how to use it, or many people, particularly in the kinds of business contexts that I think many of your listeners are coming from, you know, they have been trained in this kind of way of thinking. And so if those kinds of thinking of creative problem solving could have solved their dilemma, their conflict, it probably would have done so a long time ago, right? And it's not worked. So we want to ask you to put down your rational thinking brain and engage your imagination instead. And the best way that I know how to engage our imagination is to make it really concrete, actually, by using our 5 senses plus our emotions to imagine what the future could be like. And if you watch Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, it is unbelievable the way that he uses language to help us imagine the future that he wants for us by using the senses of sight, sound, touch. He talks about the valleys and the mountaintops. He talks about quicksand and then hearing the ringing bells of freedom. So you can feel that quicksand that you might be sinking into, but then you can hear those bells of freedom ringing. And so that imagery, that's such a great concrete example that he provides for us of what we can do for ourselves. So I encourage us all to be our own Martin Luther King Jr. and imagine, what would it look like then? What would it sound like then? What would it feel like then? So for example, I've had clients say to me, you know, I can imagine taking out, going out for dinner with this person who I work with, who I've been in serious conflict with, and I can smell the wine that we would be drinking, and I can taste the food, and I can smell it coming out of the kitchen from the restaurant that we're going to be in, and I can really imagine the good feelings that I will have from connecting with this person in a different way than we have been over the last many months.
Wow. You know, the Martin Luther King speech, you know, one's heard about it many times, but I hadn't quite processed it through the five senses. So it was fascinating to hear you talk about it. Moving to a different theme in the context of building awareness towards what's going on, Jen, you talk about two kinds of pauses, a reactive pause and a proactive pause. Can you talk a little bit about both of these?
Well, I talk about both of these pauses because they're both important. And the more you can proactively pause, the more likely you are to be successful to pause in the moments where it counts. And that's a reactive pause. So an example of a reactive pause is your, and this is what all clients always want to know, is like, when I'm stuck in the moment with somebody, how can I prevent myself from just having a knee-jerk reaction that I don't want to have, either blowing up in anger or crying or hiding and running away if I'm someone whose conflict habit is shut down? Like, how can I prevent myself from doing those things? And my best advice is, in those moments, you want to stop and you want to breathe and take a pause, even if it's just in your own mind where you're counting to 10 inside of your own head. But my own experience, and my experience helping thousands of people through this kind of process, is that if we don't proactively pause in moments where we're not in the heat of the moment with someone else facing us, it's going to be a lot harder to have that reflex come up, to have that pausing reflex come up in the moment. So the more we can have as a daily practice, even if it's just literally 2 minutes a day in the morning, you know, 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes in the evening, or just start with 1 minute, or start when you're, you know, walking to the refrigerator to get something to eat. You can build this into your daily life in any way that works for you. It can be when you turn the shower on, you remember to take a breath, or every time you buckle your seatbelt, you remember to take 3 breaths. For many years, I had a practice where literally every time I would unbuckle my seatbelt, that was my cue that I just needed to take three breaths before I was allowed to get out of the car. And it really was super helpful to me. I should probably go back to doing it. I don't know exactly what stopped it. Maybe it was the pandemic where now I don't get in the car every day. So any practice like that, where you have a regular proactive practice of pausing, will help you when you are then in the moment to remember, okay, breathe. I can breathe. Because it's putting that pause that allows you to then respond differently and free yourself from getting stuck on that conflict loop the way you always have.
This is your host, Deepak, here again. If this topic is of interest, I would urge you to listen to my conversation with Rich Fernandez of Search Inside Yourself, a leadership development organization incubated in Google. Especially the segment where he speaks about response flexibility and the notion of meta-distress. When I pressed him on how we should all develop response flexibility, he referred to the notion of an integrated practice.
Well, what I would say is ritualize it and routinize it. So make it a ritual or a routine. So personally, for me, it's the first thing I do when I wake up. I literally get up from bed, splash some water on my face, and I go downstairs to my office, and then I sit in the morning. And this is early morning before the sun is up. I'm an early riser. And before my family is awake, before I check my email or open up, you know, the laptop or look on my phone or anything, it's the first thing I do. And then the second thing I do is I brush my teeth. So it's to that level of routinization, right? It's to that level of ritualization for me. It's just the hygiene factor, I call it. So to the extent you could make the formal practice of meditation a hygiene factor, it will help make it a habit in your life. The other suggestion I have is something we offer in our curriculum, which is make it a set of integrated practices. When people think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, you know, X block of time and, you know, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice. But there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So, for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, you know, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment?
Back to what Jen says. I guess it's critical for us to respond and not react when we are in the heat of the conflict. And some of these proactive mindfulness practices can help. I guess it's a bit like net practice in cricket before the real game. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com. Let's get back to Jen now.
Moving on, one of the other pieces I found interesting was you talking about locating others' emotional expression where it belongs, which is with them. What's the nuance here, Jen?
This advice comes out of the experience of watching people get stuck on that conflict loop because they got drawn into something that could have just stayed with the other person, but once we get drawn into it, now it's our problem too. The advice also comes from so many years of emotional intelligence literature and practice and advice telling us about empathy and how to be empathetic. And I think for sure there are still many, many people for whom that advice is super important and people who need to learn how to listen more effectively, how to show empathy for other people. And there, I think, is an ever-growing, very significant portion of the population in organizational life of people who are really great at empathizing with other people. Sometimes over-empathizing, just empathizing too much or so much that it gets in our way. And so the advice to allow other people's responses and reactions to remain with them is particularly relevant for those of us who might be likely to be very good at empathizing with other people, and to remember that it's okay and in fact advisable to hold a boundary between ourselves and other people so that if someone else is yelling at me, I have a choice about whether I take that personally and tell myself the story that that's because I'm a bad person or I did something wrong or I made a mistake or not. Or maybe it's some combination, right? But at the very least, it's not only about me if someone else is yelling at me, right? It also tells me, it's also data. It tells me something about how they deal with something that they didn't like, right? So I, you know, one of the stories in the book that runs throughout the book is about Bob and Sally. And Bob has this temper where he doesn't like something and he flies off the handle. And Sally, you know, does the same thing right back. They're in this blame conflict loop. And so my work with them, part of it was about helping Bob learn how to pause before he would pick up the phone and scream at someone who, you know, was responsible for that day's client mishap. And part of it was also for Sally, helping her to not respond every time he would start screaming. And for her to take her own pause and break and just say, look, he can scream his head off, but he's going to look like a real fool. He's going to look like the fool if I just stand here and witness it versus the minute I, Sally, start yelling back, well, now I'm implicated, right? This is such a, you know, you can see this with anyone who has more than one young child any parent. Right? It's like I've said to my, I can't tell you how many times I've said to my daughter, the minute you started yelling back at him or the minute you hit him, now I'm not yelling at him, I'm yelling at you. Like, now it's your fault too. Like, if you had just come to me and said, mommy, my brother hit me, or, you know, whatever he did to you, you would have been in the clear. But now that you're implicated too, now you're both in trouble.
That's not a conflict loop. That's like a conflict nuclear explosion.
Exactly. And very common, more common with adults than we might like to admit, but it's the same exact Absolutely. Pattern.
I have an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old, so that touched a nerve.
Right, exactly. Well, I you think, can help them. Let the other person, let it stay with the other person.
Got it. And maybe just staying with it for a minute, in a way, this piece sounds a bit like the point you made around relentlessly collaborate, where something that's a virtue, which is empathy, can actually come in the way if we over-empathize. So there's a downside to too much of a good thing is the way I took it.
Yes, absolutely. Again, I think because the world of collaboration has been around for so long, for so many decades now, there is more and more a risk that the things that we've learned how to do in order to do well when we deal with conflict are the things that are now, 40 years later, getting in people's way. And that's an important thing to be aware of. And to know yourself. You know, if you know that your conflict habit is that you typically, you know, blame other people, that's one thing. But you could just as easily be someone who's relentlessly collaborating with other people, and that can just as easily get in your way. So know yourself. That's the first practice here is to know your conflict habit, identify the patterns that you typically get stuck in with other people, and then ask yourself, what's really going on here? And what could I do that would be different from what I've done before? And there you don't need anyone. I mean, the beauty of this methodology too is that you don't need anyone else's cooperation in order to free yourself from a conflict loop. It all comes from within yourself. So if someone else is going to scream their head off and you kind of disengage from that, well, then they're just, like I said before, they're just kind of screaming and you're not involved. Mm. It's a much different, there's no loop there. You're free from it.
And just sticking with this, Jen, in your work, do you see any fundamental differences in the approach that we might need to take in the context of conflict at home, whether it's spouse or parents or children or other relatives, close relatives, as compared to the way conflict shows up at work? Or are these the same set of universal principles that apply in both these kinds of situations?
The latter. Yeah, this methodology applies across all different kinds of situations, just as it has for, you know, for any methodology that helps people deal with conflict. This tends to be true. And I think that's part of the power of it, is that very often I'll be working with people in an organizational context, because that's my home, that's what I do, I'm an organizational psychologist. And then they'll come back to me and say, you know, this was really helpful with the person who I'm interacting with at work. And I also applied it with my uncle and it was super helpful there too. So thank you for that. And certainly, you know, one way that I know that this has applicability across all of these different parts of life is that I developed this methodology while teaching it as a course to students from all different walks of life, some who were mid-career professionals, others who were 22-year-olds just starting graduate school and mostly had family situations to apply it to. And the course was all built around taking the framework and applying it as part of the course in people's lives. And so I saw it applied to situations that were governmentally related and, you know, in corporate environments and in home environments, as people were dealing with parents, as people were dealing with children, as, you know, step parents, like every possible scenario really that you could think of. And that I think is part of the beauty of it.
Got it. Jen, in another section of the book, you talk about the role of values in the context of conflict. You what I found interesting was you talk about ideal values and shadow values. And I found that distinction quite interesting. Could you talk a little bit about what these are and the role they play in conflict situations?
Ideal values are the things that we typically think of when we think of values. These are things that we really care about in life and that we're proud to say that we care about. So things like love, adventure, spirituality, leadership. These are things that I personally value and that I'm proud to tell you that I value. In contrast, shadow values are things that we really care about in life that we are not proud to say that we care about. And if anyone suggested to us that we cared about them, we would deny it. These are typically things like status, power, control, autonomy, financial security. The interesting thing to me about shadow values is that they can, and values for that, ideal values for that matter, these can vary widely from person to person. So I've seen people who've put love on their list of ideal values, and then other people in the same group of people who put love as a shadow value, because this is something. Mm-hmm. So typically the way that we develop our shadow values is that it's something that we have cared about probably for most of our lives, but we've been told somewhere along the way in our lives, we got the message, this is not something that is an appropriate thing for us to value. So for some of us, you know, we grow, like, just to take love as an example, some people, we grow up in an environment where love is not something that is shown openly, not spoken about. There's not a lot of, you know, physical expression of love. And so that can show up as, you know, I really do want to express my love for other people, but this is not something that has been acceptable in my world. And so the way that shadow values can get us into trouble is that we care about something, but it's unspeakable. It's taboo. Like, for example, I might care about being recognized for a job well done, but have no language to use to tell you, my manager, that I care about being recognized for a job well done. And so I'll do all kinds of things to try to be recognized for it. I'll go out of my way to do an extra, extra, extra great job. And then what might happen is that I'll inspire jealousy on behalf of my colleagues who are wondering, why is she, you know, brown nosing the boss and like that. And so these things can cause all kinds of unintended consequences for us. Because we just don't have the language to use to say, this is something that I care about. And so what can be really helpful is for us to acknowledge for ourselves what our shadow values are, and often to find some language to describe them, if that's possible. This can also be helpful to do with regard to other people. So sometimes someone's behavior can be so grating, right? It can be so frustrating. We don't understand, why are they doing this thing that's so frustrating to me? And then if we ask ourselves, what might be a shadow value that might be driving this person's behavior that could explain it in some way, we don't have to come right out and ask them, you know, do you really care about being recognized? And is that why you seem to be, you know, sucking up to the boss? We don't have to say that. But when we're doing our analysis of the situation, we can think to ourselves, you know, maybe this person really cares about being recognized and she doesn't have the language to describe it. But I suspect that might be what's going on here. And so again, just like we were talking about one of the insights that can come out of the mapping exercise, the mapping practice, out of the shadow values exploration, we can see we may be able to draw up some empathy for other people in a way that we were not able to have before. And it may not take away the pain that we experience from having to deal with what they're doing, but it can give us the language to say, okay, I understand where it might be coming from. And that can create an opening in a relationship with another person that was not possible before.
Got it. And in the context of values, you also talk about, you know, the and versus the or, to use Jim Collins's words, you know, tyranny of the or versus magic of the and. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that might come in the way of conflict resolution?
Yes. So I can be proud to tell you what my ideal values are, that I care about leadership and I care about spirituality. And then I might want to hide away the fact that I care about recognition and status and power and control. The truth is, all of those might be things that are important to me at the same time. And just because I care about love and adventure doesn't mean that status and power are not also important to me, and vice versa. That just because control or power or status are important to me does not mean that leadership or love are not important to me. And so being able to acknowledge that all of these are sitting side by side within me, and that they probably have been for a very long time, even though I did not have the language in the past to describe that, there's something that can be very freeing for people about recognizing that. And that none of us are all shadow and or all ideal or one or the other. You know, we typically have these sitting side by side. And to acknowledge that can be very, very freeing.
And can you bring that to life with an example, maybe, just to make it relatable to the listeners?
Yeah. So I'm thinking about a family situation that a student of mine once brought. And it was a conflict that she was experiencing that involved her husband and also her husband's mother, so her mother-in-law. And she had experienced her mother-in-law as classic situation as really meddling in their lives. And she couldn't stand how the mother-in-law was just always telling her and her husband what to do, how to raise their children, how to make their home, what kind of food to serve, you know, just went on and on. And so she went through this process, this practice of identifying her own ideal and shadow values and her mother-in-law's. She tried to take her best guess at what might be her mother-in-law's ideal and shadow values. And of course, you're always just taking your best guess, unless you have a close enough, trusting enough relationship with someone else that you could have this conversation where you might even ask them, you know, what do you think some of your values might be? And you could walk them through this process. I think that's very, very rare, though, even in a situation where you have a close relationship. These can be very tough things to talk about. So you're usually taking your best educated guess. And what this student identified about her mother-in-law is that her mother-in-law both probably had an ideal value of love. She loved her son. She loved her daughter-in-law. And she also had a shadow value of control and of recognition. She wanted to be recognized as someone who had advice to share. And she wanted to control some aspects of this, of, you know, how they were raising their children and what they served for dinner. And so that all of that could be true for her mother-in-law, I think was a very powerful notion, that the mother-in-law could both be loving and also need recognition and also have some sense of wanting to control things. The control part, I think, was not as easy to take action about for my student. But what my student was able to do once she recognized that the mother-in-law couldn't come out and say, I want to be recognized as someone who has advice to share, but my student was able to go to her mother-in-law and say, you know, I want to acknowledge, like, I want you to know we really respect how much experience you've had over your lifetime. And it means a lot to us that, you know, you would let us know your recipes from your grandmother or whatever. She was, you know, so it helped raise my student's empathy for the mother-in-law. For her mother-in-law, and also enabled her to say things and treat her mother-in-law in a way that would engage their relationship in a more positive way.
Sort of proactively address some of the, not the emotions, but some of the needs that the person might have, that the person may not articulate.
Exactly. Mm. Even when they're unspoken, which they so often are in these intransigent conflict situations, there's usually shadow values at play that may need to remain unspoken, because to call them out and to name them could be so incredibly painful. And in fact, they've been pushed down so far down in people's unconscious that the mother-in-law, even if my student would have wanted to say to the mother-in-law, "I think you really want to be recognized," the mother-in-law genuinely could have responded, "No, I don't," because she genuinely was not aware that she wanted to be recognized for her expertise and advice. You know, so having that kind of conversation is like not going to really get you anywhere. Right? You're just going to be meeting someone's defensiveness, because it's all been unconsciously, unconsciously held. So yeah, so really being able to work with that unconscious part of them in a deft, skillful way can be really, really transformative.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here once again. It's interesting to hear Jen say that shadow values might be things that you might be aware of, but not acknowledge publicly. But I feel these could also be things that are in your blind spot. Others around you might see it, but you may not. In my work with leaders, one of the pieces they often find valuable is the initial assessment piece, where I try and uncover not just their strengths and development areas, but some of these deeper elements like their values, principles, what drives them, and so on. Unfortunately, we never get structured data-based feedback on these areas, and we often don't unearth these. I tell leaders, especially in the transition phase, to pause and throw light on some of these elements that are in the shadow. The only way to do that often is for me to do a series of deep dive conversations with people in the professional and the personal domain and across time without restricting it to the here and now. My question to leaders often in these situations is, how 360 is your 360? One of my earlier guests, Tasha Urich, somebody who's researched self-awareness for several years, speaks about it here.
Self-awareness is made up of two types of self-knowledge. The first is something we named internal self-awareness, which is essentially knowing who we are on the inside. What do we value? What are we passionate about? What are our aspirations? What are the patterns of behavior that we exhibit across situations? But equally important is something called external self-awareness. And in a nutshell, what that means is knowing how other people see us. And what was fascinating, at least to me in our research, was that we found that those two types of self-knowledge, both are required for us to really be self-aware, but they're not related to each other, which I was kind of surprised by. I always thought, you know, if somebody kind of knows who they are from the inside, of course they would do the work and find out how they were seen on the outside and vice versa. But we discovered that they are, you sort of have to think about them as independent skill sets within the self-awareness area.
If this is of interest, you might like my conversation with Tasha Urich and a curated playlist on self-awareness, which has perspectives from people across different walks of life. To access these, you can just go to playtopotential.com and access the guest section and look for Tasha Urich, or access the curated playlist section and look for self-awareness. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com. Let's get back to the conversation with Jen Wetzler.
Another piece you talk about in the book is the notion of metaphorical scaffolding, you say, that can help us repair relationships. I found that quite interesting as well. Could you expand on the notion of this metaphorical scaffolding?
The scaffolding that I'm talking about is very simple things like where and when you're going to have a tough conversation with someone and choosing that, or allowing them to choose that. Right? Saying to someone, we need to talk about X, but I'm totally open to when we do this, when works for you. Or thinking about it as changing the channels. Like if you're normally having tense conversations with your team around a board table or on a Zoom call, to think about how can we switch things up so that we're not having things in the same settings. So in a physical environment, if you're always sitting around, you know, the conference table, well, what could it look like? I mean, there's a reason why people have offsites, right? Because changing the location can relax people. It really can shift things up and make it easier to have a different kind of conversation in a different environment. So asking someone to go take a walk or meeting people in a cafe as opposed to the, you know, a formal conference room. Even those small moves can make a big difference. As far as, you know, Zoom, sometimes just changing the configuration of people. So sometimes my experience is that my clients will expect to have a useful conversation with all 15 people that are part of a team at the same time. And all I'll do is suggest that they have various sets of smaller conversations first before they all get together in that room with 15 people, whether that's a Zoom room or a physical room. And man, I mean, that makes a huge difference. So that's what I'm talking about, the scaffolding, that these are things that may seem simple, but actually they're much more important than we like to give them credit for. And it can be helpful to pay attention to them.
One of the things I find interesting in this podcast is I come across terms that we use so commonly in our daily life. And you meet an expert and they throw a totally different perspective. I was speaking to Matt Walker, a gentleman who's researched sleep for a few decades. And he spent 5 minutes talking about why sleeping over something has, there's a scientific reason behind why if you sleep over something, you'll end up in a better place. So when you mentioned go take a walk, I'm going to that phrase is going to mean something very different from tomorrow for me.
Great.
Just changing the setting, I guess, makes such a difference to getting to a better outcome.
Yes, it definitely does. Take a walk. Take a walk. Ask someone to go take a walk rather than sitting and talking to each other. The movement, there's something about movement, especially if you're someone who you know about yourself that you are a kinesthetic person. And also you can ask yourself who are the other people involved here and who will I be talking to? And are they someone who might appreciate nature or the outdoors or getting a breath of fresh air or the movement as well? And that's a great question to ask.
The other thing that I found interesting was, you talk about small experiments and you suggest a prototyping approach to getting out of conflict rather than shooting for the ideal outcome. You sort of say that let's take baby steps towards it. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and how that plays out in a conflict context?
Yes, I talk about mini experiments. So if you've been doing your conflict habit and that's not working for you, you know what you don't want to do, but you don't really know what you do want to do. So my best advice is to start small. Start in a safe environment, actually. So if you're in a really tough situation with somebody from work, try testing out a new behavior with someone from home where the stakes are going to be lower. So, you know, if your conflict habit is relentlessly collaborate and you've decided that doing something different might look like being direct, and instead of asking someone else what it is that they want and then trying to figure out options that could meet their interests and yours, you're just going to tell the other person, you know, you want to test out telling someone what it is that you need and just being more direct. So you could try that out with your partner at home or with a kid at home and just be more direct in a situation and see what happens. What's the feedback? I ask people to take notes in a very simple way. So you do a behavior. So in this case, you know, say something directly, here's what I need in this situation, and then see what happens and write down for yourself what worked well about what I did and what would I do differently next time. And I always encourage people to put at least 3 bullets under each side, each question. You know, on the one left-hand side of the page, what worked well, 3 bullets. Right-hand side, what would I do differently, 3 bullets. And it's all framed in the positive, right? I didn't say, what do I criticize about myself? I said, what would I do differently next time? So that you're constantly feeding back some really helpful information to yourself about what you would do differently next time. And then you take it into the more tricky environment at work and do your experiments there, right? See how it goes. And, you know, keep testing in small ways until you find what works.
And you talk about this notion of a pattern breaking path. And I really, really love the example that you gave of President Carter at Camp David. You talk about the incident of President Carter offering three photographs addressed to Begin's children. And you talk about how that provides a breakthrough to a sort of a deadlock till then. Can you sort of share this example and talk about the broader insight here?
Yes, there are two different things that you just mentioned. One is the pattern breaking path, and then one is the example of Carter, which I think makes us related and slightly different points. So I'm going to take them separately. Mm. The pattern breaking path, there are three focus points to it. One is when you think about what is a pattern breaking path? First of all, it's made up of a set of actions. So when you are finding your way out of the conflict loop, it's not just going to be one action that's going to set you free because you've been going around on that loop presumably for a while. It's more likely going to be a set of actions that's going to help you out of that loop towards an optimal outcomes loop that will then become its own self-reinforcing pattern. So you're looking at a set of actions that one builds on the next, builds on the next, builds on the next. Number two, you want to keep your actions simple, because typically when you're stuck in a conflict loop, the situation is already pretty complex, like we were talking about before. So you don't want to add more complexity on top of it. So you want to keep your actions simple so that you can track your impact over time, and so that it's more likely that your action will have the intention, will have the intended effect. And three, you want to make your actions surprisingly different than you've had before. The surprising nature, right? So if you've been relentlessly collaborating with people and it's not working, you being direct and saying, here's what I need from you, that will surprise people, and it will jolt them potentially out of the conflict loop as well, or at least it has a higher likelihood of jolting them out of the conflict loop as well in a good way. It will help them respond differently than they've been responding in the past. So then you're both freed from that conflict loop. So that's what it means to create a pattern-breaking path. Now, this example of Jimmy Carter absolutely has some aspects of what I just described on it, particularly the surprising nature of it. So the story is that Jimmy Carter in 1978 brought to Camp David the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, who was Menachem Begin, and the President of Egypt, Anwar Sadat. He brought them because he wanted to help them make peace between Israel and Egypt. And he, after many days, the negotiations had broken down. Neither side was willing to budge, and each leader, Begin and Sadat, was packing up his bags to go home. And so Carter went and asked his assistant to find three pictures of the three of them, of Carter, Begin, and Sadat, that had been taken earlier in the week. And Carter signed each picture and addressed each picture to the grandchildren of Begin, who Begin had told Carter about earlier in the week. And so Carter goes and knocks on the door, on Begin's door, as he's packing to go home, and hands these pictures to Begin. And as Begin looks at one postcard and then the next and the next, he begins to cry. And within the next day, Begin had stopped packing and went back to the negotiation table and made a historic peace agreement that is in effect to this day. And what I love about this story is, first of all, the surprising nature of what Jimmy Carter did. But the real point to me of this story is about the power of helping people see the unintended consequences of their actions on people who may not be immediately obviously involved in the situation. So what Jimmy Carter did there was that he, like we were talking about mapping, he widened the situation for Begin, right? So Begin was so focused on not having gotten what he wanted from Sadat in the prior negotiations that week. But when Carter helped Begin imagine his grandchildren and the lives of war that they would continue to have to experience, future generations would continue to experience because of Begin's failure to come to an agreement with Egypt, with Sadat, that is what really got to Begin emotionally and enabled him to go back to the negotiating table and make an agreement. So the power of asking ourselves, what might be the unintended consequences of my actions here, either my actions or of my inactions, and then allowing that to help us see, do I want to do something different here? To me, that's very powerful.
Fascinating. Jen, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. As we wrap up, given all the work you do and your research around conflict and everything else, net-net, how do you think about the phrase play to potential?
I think about it as we should all be playing to our highest potential, looking at what are the ways that we can live at our highest potential. And as that relates to the work that we've been talking about together over the last while, I would say your ability to free yourself from conflict, even without anyone else's cooperation, will help you live at your highest potential. It will help you play to your highest potential.
Jen, thank you so much for your time and your insights. Really, really insightful talking to you.
Thank you so much, Deepak. I love your questions and just great to be in conversation with you and in your presence. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. If you find the podcast purposeful, do take a moment and contribute to Antarang Foundation, a nonprofit that I work with closely. I've seen their work up close and can vouch for their impact with young adults who come from challenging backgrounds. As a matter of fact, two of the editors of the podcast, Akash Diore and Armand Bansod, come through Antarang Foundation. While we are battling the health crisis given COVID-19, we cannot afford to ignore the issue of solving for livelihoods in our battle to save lives. You can get more details of the work they do at the paid forward section at playtopotential.com. Do also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering the podcast amidst a lot of noise out there, given the boom in the podcast supply in India in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. Thank you, and hope to have you tune in to one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.